be tithed, and would experience the glorious mystery of having a divided body and a networked soul. Not networked in the computer sense, for the pouring of one's soul into hardware happens only in the movies, and never to good results. No, this would be a true networking within living flesh, a stretching of her spirit among the dozens of people touched by her divided body. There are people who say it's death, but she believes it to be something else, something mystical, and she believes it with every ounce of her soul.
I suppose one cannot know what such division is like until one experiences it,
her priest once told her. It struck her as odd that the priest, who was always so confident in church dogma, spoke of uncertainty whenever he talked about tithing.
The Vatican is yet to take a position on unwinding,
he pointed out.
And so, until it is either condoned or condemned, I can be as uncertain about it as I please.
It always made her bristle when he called tithing unwinding, as if they were the same thing. They're not. The way she sees it, the cursed and unwanted are unwound, but the blessed and the loved are tithed. The process might be the same, but the intent is different, and in this world intent is everything. Her name is Miracolina, from the Italian word for miracle. She was named this because she was conceived to save her brother's life. Her brother, Matteo, was diagnosed with leukemia when he was 10. The family had moved from Rome to Chicago for his treatment, but even with harvest banks all over the nation, a marrow match could not be found for his rare blood type. The only way to save him was to create a match, and so that's exactly what his parents did. 9 months later, Miracolina was born. Doctors took marrow from her hip and gave it to Matteo, and her brother was saved. Easy as that. Now he's 24 and in graduate school, all thanks to Miracolina. Even before she understood what it meant to be a tithe, she knew she was 10% of a larger whole.
We had 10 embryos in vitro,
her mother once told her.
Only one was a match for Matteo, and that was you. You are no accident, mi carina. We chose you.
The law was very specific when it came to the other 9 embryos. Her family had to pay 9 women to carry them to term. After that, the surrogates could do as they pleased, either raise the babies or stork them to a good home.
But whatever it cost, it was worth it,
her parents had told her,
to have both Matteo and you.
Now, as her tithing approaches, it comforts Miracolina to know that she has 9 fraternal twins out there. And who knows? Maybe a part of her divided self will go to help one of these unknown twins. As to why she is being tithed, it has nothing to do with percentages.
We made a pact with God,
her parents told her when she was young,
that if you were born and Matteo was saved, we would show our gratitude by gifting you back to God through tithing.
Miracolina understood, even at an early age, that such a powerful pact was not easily broken. Lately, however, her parents have become more and more emotional at the thought of it.
Forgive us,
they begged her over and over again, quite often in tears.
Please, forgive us for this thing we've done.
And she would always forgive them, even though the request baffled her. Miracolina always felt blessed to be a tithe, to know without question her destiny and her purpose. Why should her parents feel sorry for giving her a purpose? Perhaps the guilt they feel is not for throwing her a big party, but then that had been her own choice.
First of all,
she told her parents,
a tithing should be solemn, not loud. Secondly, who's going to come?
They couldn't dispute her logic. While most tithes come from rich communities and belong to the kinds of churches that expect tithing, theirs is a working-class neighborhood that's not exactly tithe-friendly. When you're like those rich families, surrounding yourself with like-minded people, there are plenty of friends to support you at a tithing party, enough to offset the guests who find it uncomfortable. But if Miracolina had a party, everyone there would feel awkward. That's not how she wanted to spend her last night with her family. So, there's no party. Instead, she spends the evening in front of the fireplace, sitting between her parents and clicking through favorite scenes from favorite movies. Her mom even prepares her favorite meal, rigatoni americana.
"Bold and spicy,"
her mom says.
"Just like you."
She sleeps that night, having no unpleasant dreams, or at least none she can remember, and in the morning she rises early, dresses in her simple daily whites, and tells her parents that she's going to school.
"The van doesn't come for me until 4 this afternoon, so why waste the day?"
Although her parents would prefer she stay home with them, her wishes come first on this day. At school she sits through classes, already feeling a dreamy distance from it all. At the end of each class, the teacher awkwardly hands her all her collected classwork and grades, calculated early.
"Well then, I guess that's that," each teacher says in one way or another. Most of them can't wait for her to get out of their room.
Her science teacher is the kindest, though, taking some extra time with her.
"My nephew was tithed a few years ago," he tells her. "A wonderful boy. I miss him terribly."
He pauses, seeming to go far away in his thoughts.
"I was told his heart went to a firefighter who saved a dozen people from a burning building. I don't know if it's true, but I'd like to believe it is."
Miracolina would like to believe it, too. Throughout the day, her classmates are just as awkward as her teachers. Some kids make a point to say goodbye. Some even give her uncomfortable hugs. But the rest say their farewells from a safe distance, as if tithing is somehow contagious. And then there are the other ones, the cruel ones.
"See you here and there,"
a boy says behind her back during lunch, and the kids around him snicker. Miracolina turns, and the boy tries to hide behind his gaggle of friends, thinking he's safe within that cloud of rank middle school perspiration. But she recognizes his voice and knows exactly who it is. She pushes through his friends to coldly face him.
"Oh, you won't see me, Zach Rasmussen. But if any part of me sees you, I will definitely let you know."
Zach's face goes a little green.
"Get lost," he says. "Go get tithed."
But still there's that look of uneasy fear beneath his idiotic bravado.
"Good,"
thinks Miracolina.
"I hope I've given him a few nightmares."
Her school is a huge one, so even though tithes aren't common in her neighborhood, there are four others, all dressed in white like her. There used to be six, but the oldest two are already gone. These remaining tithes are her true friends. These are the ones to whom she feels a need to say one last goodbye. Oddly, they're all from different backgrounds and faiths. Each is a member of a splinter sect of their particular religion, a sect that takes its commitment to self-sacrifice very seriously. Funny, Miracolina thinks, how these same religions fought over their differences for thousands of years, and yet in tithing they all come together as one.
"We are all asked to give of ourselves, to be charitable and selfless,"
says Nestor, her tithe friend closest to her in age, only a month short of his own tithing. He clasps her hands, giving Miracolina a warm goodbye.
"If technology allows us a new way to give, how could it be wrong?"
Except there are people who do say that it's wrong. More and more people these days. There's even that ex-tithe out there, the one who became a clapper, who people hold up as an example. Well, how stable can he be? After all, he became a clapper, for goodness sake. The way Miracolina sees it, if someone would rather blow themselves up than be tithed, well, that's like stealing from the collection plate, isn't it? It's just plain wrong. When the school day ends, she walks home just like on any other day. As she comes onto her street, she sees her brother's car in the driveway. She's surprised at first. He goes to school 5 hours away. But she's happy Mateo's come to see her off. It's 3 o'clock, an hour until the van comes, and her parents are already crying. She wishes they weren't, that they could take this as stoically as she, or even Mateo, who spends his time chatting about only the good memories.
"Remember that time we went to Rome, and you wanted to play hide-and-seek in the Vatican Museum?"
Miracolina smiles at the memory. She had tried to hide in Nero's bathtub, this huge maroon stone bowl that could practically fit an elephant.
The security guards had a fit. I thought they'd take me to the Pope and he'd spank me. So I ran.
Matteo laughs. You went missing for like an hour. Mom and Dad were pulling their hair out. Missing isn't the word for it, though. You don't go missing in a museum. You just get temporarily absorbed by the walls. She remembers moving through the crowds of the Vatican until she found herself standing in the middle of the Sistine Chapel, gazing up toward Michelangelo's masterpiece, which covered the walls and ceiling. And there in the center was the divine link between heaven and earth. So close was Adam's hand to the hand of God, both straining to touch each other, but the impossible weight of gravity kept Adam from truly touching the heavens. She stood there, looking up, forgetting that she was supposed to be hiding, for who could hide in a place that was all about revealed mystery? And that's exactly where her family found her, amid hundreds of tourists, staring up at the greatest work of art ever created by the hand of man, humanity's grandest attempt to touch perfection. She was only 6, but even then, the images of the chapel spoke to her, although she had no idea what they said. All she knew was that she herself was just like this beautiful place, and if someone could go inside her, they would see glorious frescoes painted on the walls of her soul. The van arrives 10 minutes early and waits out front. There's a brightly painted logo on the van's side that reads, Wood Hollow Harvest Camp, a place for teens. Miracolina goes to her room to get her suitcase, a small one filled with just a few sets of tithing whites and some basic necessities. Now her parents cry and cry, begging again for her forgiveness. This time, however, it just angers her.
If tithing makes you feel guilty, that's not my problem,
she tells them.
Because I'm at peace with it. Please have enough respect for me to be at peace with it, too.
It doesn't help matters. It just makes their tears flow in a steadier stream.
The only reason you're at peace with it,
her father tells her,
is because we made you feel that way. It's our fault. It's all our fault.
Miracolina looks at them and shrugs.
So change your mind, then,
she suggests.
Break your pact with God and don't tithe me.
They look back at her like she's giving them a glorious gift, a reprieve from hell. Even Matteo is hopeful.
Yes, that's what we'll do,
her mother says.
We haven't signed the final papers yet. We can still change our minds.
Fine,
says Miracolina.
Are you sure that's what you want?
Yes,
says her father with intense relief.
Yes, we're sure.
Positive?
Yes.
Good. Now you can be guilt-free.
Miracolina picks up her suitcase.
But regardless of what you choose, I'm going anyway. That's my choice.
Then she hugs her mother, father, and brother, and leaves without looking back, without even saying goodbye, because goodbyes imply an end, and more than anything else in this life, Miracolina Roselli wants to believe that her tithing is a beginning. Advertisement.
When Billy's behavior became too much for us to bear, and we began to fear for our own safety, we did the only humane thing. We sent him to harvest camp so he could find fulfillment in a divided state. But now, with an age restriction preventing 17-year-olds from being unwound, we wouldn't have had that choice. Just last week, a 17-year-old girl in our neighborhood got drunk, crashed her car, and killed 2 innocent people. Would it still have happened if her parents could have chosen to send her to harvest camp? You tell me.
Vote yes on Prop 46. End the Cap 17 law and lift the ban on late teen unwinding.
Paid for by Citizens for a Wholesome Tomorrow.
It's a 3-hour drive to Wood Hollow Harvest Camp. The van is all plush leather seats and pop music pumped through expensive speakers. The driver is a man with a salt-and-pepper beard, a big smile, and just enough of a gut to be jolly. Santa Claus in training.
Excited for your big day?
Chauffeur Claus asks as they drive away from Miracolina's home and family.
Did you have a big tithing party?
Yes and no,
she says.
I'm excited, but no party.
Oh, well, that's too bad. Why not?
Because tithing shouldn't be about me.
Oh,
is all Chauffeur Claus can say to that. Miracolina's response is the perfect conversation killer, which is fine. The last thing she wants is to recap her life for this man, no matter how jolly he is.
There are drinks in the cooler,
he tells her.
Help yourself.
And then he leaves her alone. 20 minutes into the drive, instead of turning onto the interstate, they enter a gated community.
One more pickup this afternoon,
Chauffeur Claus tells her.
Tuesdays are lean, so it's just this stop. Hope you don't mind.
Not at all.
They stop at a house that's at least 3 times larger than her own, where a boy in white waits out front with his family. She does not watch as he says his goodbyes. She looks out of the other window, giving them their privacy. Finally, Chauffeur Claus opens the door, and in comes a boy with straight dark hair, perfectly trimmed, bright blue eyes, and skin as pale as bone china, as if he had been kept out of the sun all his life to keep his skin pure as a baby's bottom for his tithing.
Hi,
he says shyly. His tithing whites are shiny satin and trimmed in fine gold brocade. This boy's parents spared no expense. Miracolina's tithing whites, on the other hand, are simple raw silk, unbleached so their whiteness won't be so blinding that it draws attention to itself. Compared to hers, this boy's whites are like a neon advertisement. The seats in the van aren't in rows. They all face center to encourage camaraderie. The boy sits across from Miracolina, thinks for a moment, then reaches across the gap, offering his hand for her to shake.
I'm Timothy,
he says. She shakes his hand. It's clammy and cold, like the way your hands get before a school play.
My name's Miracolina.
Wow, that's a mouthful.
Then he chuckles, probably mad at himself for saying it.
Do people call you Mira or Lena or something to shorten it?
It's Miracolina,
she tells him,
and no one shortens it.
Okay, well, pleased to meet you, Miracolina.
The van starts up, and Timothy waves goodbye to his large family still outside. And although they wave to him as well, it's clear that they can't even see him through the dark glass. The van pulls out and begins to wind out of the neighborhood. Even before they leave the gate, Timothy begins to look uncomfortable, like he's got a stomach ache. But Miracolina knows if his stomach bothers him, it's just a symptom of something else. This boy has not found peace with his tithing yet. Or if he had, he lost it the moment the van door closed, cutting the umbilical to his old life. As insulted as she is by his lavish whites and exclusive neighborhood, Miracolina begins to feel sorry for him. His fear hangs in the air around them like a web full of black widows. No one should journey to their tithing in terror.
So, the ride is like 3 hours or something?
Timothy asks, his voice shaky.
Yes,
says Chauffeur Claus brightly.
There's an entertainment system with hundreds of pre-programmed movies to pass the time. Help yourselves.
Yeah, okay, sure,
says Timothy.
Maybe later, though.
For a few minutes, he seems lost in his own thoughts. Then he turns to Miracolina again.
They say tithes get treated really well at Harvest Camp. You think it's true? They say it's lots of fun, and we're with tons of other kids just like us.
He clears his throat.
And they say we even get to choose the day when we,
Miracolina smiles at him warmly. Usually tithes like Timothy go to Harvest Camp in a limo, but she knows why Timothy didn't, without having to ask. He didn't want to make the journey alone. Well, if fate has brought them together on this momentous day, she will be the friend he needs.
I'm sure Harvest Camp will be just the experience you want it to be,
she tells him.
And when you choose your date, you'll choose it because you're ready. That's why they let us choose. So it's our decision, no one else's.
Timothy looks into her with those piercing, perfect eyes.
You're not scared at all, are you?
She chooses to answer his question with another question.
Have you ever been on an airplane?
she asks him.
Huh?
Timothy is thrown by the change of subject.
Yeah, a bunch of times.
Were you scared the first time you flew?
Yeah, sure, I guess.
But you went anyway. Why?
Timothy shrugs.
I wanted to get where I was going, and my parents were with me and said it would be okay.
Well,
says Miracolina,
there you go.
Timothy looks at her, blinking with a kind of innocence Miracolina doesn't think she ever had.
So then, you're not scared?
She sighs.
Yes, I'm scared,
she admits.
Very scared. But when you trust that it will all be okay, you can enjoy the fear. You can use it to help you instead of letting it hurt you.
Oh, I get it,
says Timothy.
It's like a scary movie, you know? You can have fun with it because you know it's not real no matter how scared it makes you.
Then he thinks about it a bit more.
But getting unwound is real. It's not like we're going to walk out of the theater and go home. It's not like I'm going to get off a plane and be in Disneyland.
Tell you what,
Miracolina says, before Timothy can drag himself back into his pit of spider-filled despair.
Let's watch one of those scary movies and get it all out of our systems before we get to Harvest Camp.
Timothy nods obediently.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
But as she scrolls through all the pre-programmed movies, none of them are scary. They're all family films and comedies.
It's okay,
says Timothy.
To tell you the truth, I don't like scary movies anyway.
In a few minutes, they're on the interstate making good time. Timothy contents himself with video games to keep his mind from going to dark places, and Miracolina puts in her earphones, listening to her own eclectic mix of music rather than the van's vapid pop tunes. There are 2,129 songs in her iChip, and she's determined to listen to as many as she can before the day she enters the divided state. About 2 hours and 30 songs later, the van exits the interstate and turns down a scenic road winding through dense woods.
Just half an hour now,
chauffeur Claus tells them.
We make good time!
Then, as they come around a bend, he slams on the brakes and the van screeches to a halt. Miracolina takes off her earphones.
What's going on? What's wrong?
Stay here,
orders chauffeur Claus, no longer jolly, and he jumps out of the van. Timothy already has his nose pressed against the window, looking out.
This can't be good.
No,
agrees Miracolina.
It can't.
Just off the road in a ditch is another Wood Hollow Harvest Camp van, but this one is overturned, wheels to the sky. There's no telling how long it's been there.
He must have blown a tire or something and skidded off the road,
says Timothy, but none of the tires look blown.
We should call for help,
says Miracolina. But no one brings a phone to Harvest Camp, so neither she nor Timothy has one. Just then, there's a commotion outside. Half a dozen people dressed in black, with faces hidden by ski masks, come leaping out of the woods from all directions. The chauffeur is hit with a tranq bullet to the neck and goes down like an overstuffed rag doll.
Lock the door!
Shouts Miracolina and doesn't wait. She pushes Timothy out of the way to get to the driver's unlocked door, but she's not fast enough. Just as she reaches for the lock, the door is pulled open, and the assailant hits the button that pops all the locks. All the van's doors are pulled open at once by the masked attackers. Clearly these attackers have done this before and have gotten good at it. Timothy screams as hands reach in, pulling him out. He tries to wriggle free, but it's useless. If his fear is a web, then the spiders have got him. Two more figures reach for Miracolina, and she drops to the floor, kicking at them.
Don't you touch me! Don't you touch me!
Her fear, which had been so well under control, explodes from her now, because this violation of her journey is a far greater unknown than Harvest Camp. She kicks and bites and claws in terror and outrage, but it's no use. Because in the end, she hears the telltale pfft of a tranq gun firing. She feels the sharp jab of the tranq bullet as it embeds itself in her arm, and the world goes dark as she spirals helplessly into that timeless place where all sedated souls go. Advertisement.
You don't know me, but you know someone like me. I was diagnosed with liver cancer the same week I got my acceptance letter to Harvard. My parents and I didn't think it was a problem, but when we talked to our doctor, we found out there was an organ shortage and livers were in short supply. They told me I'd have to be on a waiting list. Now, 3 months later, my name still hasn't come up, and that acceptance letter? Well, I guess my education is going to have to wait. And now the same people who lowered the age restriction on unwinding want to have a 6-month waiting period once parents sign an unwind order, in case they change their minds. 6 months? I won't be here in 6 months.
Waffling kills. Vote no on Prop 53.
Paid for by parents for a positive future.
Waking up after being tranked is not a pleasant experience. With consciousness comes a splitting headache, a terrible taste in one's mouth, and the disturbing feeling that something has been stolen from you. Miracolina awakes to the sound of someone crying beside her, begging for mercy. She recognizes the voice as Timothy's. He's definitely not the kind of boy built to handle something like this. She can't see him, though, because her eyes are covered by a thick blindfold.
"It's all right, Timothy,"
she calls to him.
"Whatever's going on, it's going to be okay."
Hearing her voice makes his pleas and sobs settle into whimpers. Miracolina shifts to feel the position of her body. She's sitting upright, and her neck aches from the position in which it had hung while she slept. Her hands are behind her back, tied together. Her legs are tied to the chair she sits in. Not painfully, but tight enough to ensure she won't break free.
"Okay,"
says the voice of a boy in front of them.
"You can take off their blindfolds."
Her blindfold is pulled off, and although the light around her is not bright, it's still painful to keep her eyes open. She squints, slowly letting her eyes adjust and focus. They're in some sort of grand, high-ceiling ballroom. Crystal chandeliers, artwork on the walls. It looks like the kind of place where French royalty would have entertained high society before getting themselves beheaded. Except that this place is falling apart. There are holes in the ceiling through which pigeons freely fly in and out of the daylight. The paintings are peeling with weather damage, and the rank smell of mildew fills the air. There's no telling how far they've been taken from their destination.
"I'm really sorry we had to do it this way,"
the boy sitting in front of them says. He's not dressed like any sort of royalty, even moldy royalty. He wears simple jeans and a light blue t-shirt. His hair is pale brown, almost blonde, and too long, like he hasn't had a haircut in recent memory. He seems to be her age, but the tired look around his eyes makes him appear older, like he's seen many more things than anyone ought to see at their age. He also seems a little bit frail in some indefinable way.
"We couldn't risk you getting hurt, or figuring out where we were taking you. It was the only way to safely rescue you."
"Rescue us?"
says Miracolina, speaking up for the first time.
"Is that what you call this?"
"Well, it might not feel that way at the moment, but yes, that's exactly what we've done."
And all at once, Miracolina knows who this is. A wave of rage and nausea courses through her. Of all the unfair things to happen to her, why did she have to face this? Why did she have to be captured by him? She feels the kind of anger, the kind of hatred she knows is not good for her soul, especially this close to her tithing. But try as she might, she can't purge herself of the bitterness. Then Timothy gasps, and his watery eyes go wide.
"You're him,"
he says with the kind of enthusiasm boys like Timothy usually save for encounters with sports stars.
"You're that tithe who became a clapper. You're Levi Calder."
The boy across from them nods and smiles.
"Yes, but my friends call me Lev."
3. Cam. Wrist, ankles, neck, strapped down. Itching, itching all over. Can't move. He flexes his hands and feet in the bonds. Side to side, up and down. It scratches the itch, but makes it burn.
"You're awake,"
says a voice that's familiar and yet not.
"Good. Very good."
He turns his neck. No one. Just white walls around him. the scrape of a chair. Closer, closer. The person who spoke comes into blurry view, moving her chair into his line of sight, sitting, legs crossed, smiling, but not smiling, not really.
I was wondering when you'd wake up.
She wears dark pants and a blouse, pattern of the blouse too blurry to make out, and the color, he can't put a finger on the color.
Roy G. B.,
he says, searching.
Yellow, blue, no.
He grunts. His throat hurts when he speaks, and the words come out raspy.
Grass, trees, devil puke.
Green,
the woman says.
That's the word you're looking for, isn't it? My blouse is green.
Can the woman read minds? Maybe not. Maybe she's just clever. Her voice is gentle and refined. There's an accent to it. Slightly British, perhaps. It automatically makes him want to trust her.
Do you recognize me?
She asks.
No. Yes.
He says, feeling his thoughts cinched in bonds tighter than the ones that secure him to the bed.
Fair enough,
says the woman.
This is all very new to you. You must be frightened.
Until that moment, it hasn't occurred to him that he should be frightened at all. But now that the cross-legged, green-shirted woman says he must be, then he must be. He tugs against his bonds in fear. The burning itch begins to hurt even more, and it brings forth a jagged shattering of memories that he must speak aloud.
Hand on stove! Belt buckle! Ah! No! Mom! No! Falling from bike, broken arm! Knife! He stabbed me with a knife!
Pain,
says the cross-legged woman calmly.
Pain is the word you're looking for.
It is a magic word, for it calms him down.
Pain,
he repeats, hearing the word as it spills from strange vocal cords and over unfamiliar lips. He stops struggling. The pain fades to burning, and the burning fades to an itch once more. But the thoughts that came along with the pain are still there. The burned hand, the angry mother, the broken arm, and a knife fight that he never fought and yet somehow did. Somehow, all these things happened to him. He looks again to the woman, who studies him coolly. Now that his focus is better, he can see the pattern of the blouse.
Based. Palsy. Haley.
Keep trying,
says the woman.
It's in there somewhere.
His brain twitches. He struggles. Thinking feels like a race. A long, grueling Olympic race.
What is that race called? It starts with an M.
Paisley,
he says triumphantly.
Marathon! Paisley!
Yes? I imagine this is as exhausting as a marathon for you,
says the woman.
But it was worth the effort.
She touches the collar of her blouse.
You're right. It does have a Paisley pattern.
She smiles, this time for real, and touches his forehead with her fingertip. He can feel the tip of her nail.
I told you it was in there.
Now that his thoughts are beginning to settle, he realizes that he does recognize the woman, but has no idea from where.
Who?
He asks.
Who? Where? When? How? What? And why?
She adds with a smirk.
Your question words have all returned.
Oh,
he demands again, not appreciating the joke at his expense. She sighs.
Who am I? You can say I'm your touchstone, your connection to the world, and in a sense, your translator, because I can understand you where few others can. I'm an expert in metalinguistics.
Meta. Meta.
It's the nature of the language you speak. Metaphoric associations. But I can see I'm confusing you. It's not for you to worry about. My name is Roberta, but you wouldn't know that because I never told you my name in all the times you've seen me.
All the times?
Roberta nods.
You can say you've only seen me once, yet you've also seen me many, many times. What do you think of that?
It's a marathon again as he searches through his mind for the word he wants to say.
In the caves. Answer, or you can't cross the bridge. It's black and white and red all over.
Work for it, says Roberta. I know you can do it.
Riddle, he says. Yes, marathon, but worth it. The word, riddle.
Very good.
Roberta gently touches his hand. He takes a long look at her. She is older than him. He knows this, even though he has no idea how old he actually is. She's pretty, in a motherly sort of way. Blonde hair with a hint of brown roots, and just a little makeup. Her eyes seem younger than the rest of her face. But that blouse.
Medusa, he says.
Crone! Witch! Crooked, rotten teeth!
She stiffens a bit.
You think I'm ugly?
Ugly,
he says, savoring the word.
No, not you. Ugly, green, paisley ugly.
Roberta laughs, relieved, and glances down at her blouse.
Well, I guess there's no accounting for taste, is there?
Accounting? Accountant? My father was an accountant. No, a policeman. No, a factory worker. No, a lawyer. Construction worker. Pharmacist. Dentist. Unemployed. Dead.
His thoughts are all true and all false. His own mind is a riddle that he can't hope to solve. He feels the fear that Roberta told him he must feel. It wells up again, and he begins to struggle once more against his bonds. They're not just bonds, though. Some of them are bandages.
Who?
He asks again.
I already told you, Roberta says. Don't you remember?
No! Who?
He asks.
Who?
Roberta raises her eyebrows in understanding.
Oh, who are you?
He waits anxiously for an answer.
Well, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Who are you?
She taps her fingertips on her chin, considering it.
The committee could not agree on a name. Of course, everyone has an opinion, the pompous buffoons. So, while they're dickering about it, perhaps you can choose one for yourself.
Choose?
But why must he choose a name? Shouldn't he already have one? He runs a series of names through his mind. Matthew, Johnny, Eric, Jose, Chris, Alex, Spencer. And although some of them seem more likely than others, none of them hold the sense of identity that a true name should have. He shakes his head, trying to push something, anything, about himself into its proper place. But shaking his head only makes it hurt.
Aspirin, he says. Tylenol aspirin. Then count the sheep.
Yes, I imagine you must still be tired. We'll up your pain medication, and I'll leave you to get some rest. We'll talk more tomorrow.
She pats his hand, then strides out of the room, turning off the light and leaving him alone with thought fragments that won't as much as shake hands with one another in the dark. The next day, or at least he thinks it's the next day, he's not quite so tired, and his head doesn't hurt as much, but he's still just as confused. He now suspects that the white room that he took for a hospital room is not. There were enough hints in the architecture to suggest he was in some private residence that had been retrofitted for the convalescence of a single patient. There is a sound beyond the window that he can hear even when the window is closed, a constant rhythmic roar and hiss. Only after a day of hearing it does he realize what it is, crashing waves. Wherever he is, it's on a seashore, and he longs to see the view. He asks, and Roberta obliges. Today is the day he gets out of bed. Two strong, uniformed guards come in with Roberta. They undo his bonds and help him to his feet, holding him beneath his armpits.
Don't be afraid,
Roberta says.
I know you can do this.
The first moment of standing gives him vertigo. He looks to his bare feet, seeing only toes sticking out from beneath the pale blue hospital gown he wears. Those toes seem miles beneath him. He begins to walk, one labored step at a time.
Good,
says Roberta, walking along with him.
How does it feel?
Skydiving, he says.
Hmm,
says Roberta, considering this.
Do you mean dangerous or exhilarating?
Yes, he answers. In his mind, he repeats both words, remembering them, pulling them from a massive box of unsorted adjectives and filing them in their proper place. There are so many unsorted words in the box, but bit by bit, it's all beginning to slide into coherent formation.
It's all in there,
Roberta has told him more than once.
It's just a matter of finding it.
The two guards continue to hold him beneath his armpits as he shuffles along. A knee buckles and their grip grows tighter.
Careful, sir.
The guards always call him sir. It must mean that he commands respect, although he can't imagine why. He envies their ability to simply be without having to work at it. Roberta leads them down a hallway that, like the distance to his feet, seems like miles, but is only a dozen yards or so. Up above, in the corner of the ceiling, there's a machine with a lens that zeroes in on him. There's a machine like that in his room, too, constantly watching him in silence. Electric eye, Cyclops lens. He knows the name for the device. It's on the tip of his tongue.
Say cheese,
he says.
It puts on 10 pounds. Rolling and action. A Kodak moment.
The word you're looking for starts with a C, and that's all the help I'll give you,
Roberta says.
Cadaver. Cabana. Cavalry. Canada.
Roberta purses her lips.
You can do better.
He sighs and gives up before frustration can overwhelm him. Right now, it's hard to master walking, much less walking and thinking at the same time. Now they come through a door to a place that is both inside and out.
Balcony,
he says.
Yes,
Roberta tells him.
That one came easy.
Beyond the balcony is an endless sea, shimmering in the warm sun. And before him are two chairs and a small table. On the table are cookies and a white beverage in a crystal pitcher. He should know the name of that beverage.
Comfort food,
Roberta tells him.
Your reward for making the journey.
They sit facing each other with the food between them and the guards at the ready, should he need their help, or should he try to hurl himself off the balcony to the jagged rocks below. There are soldiers with dark, heavy weapons positioned strategically on those rocks. There for his protection, Roberta tells him. He imagines that should he hurl himself down to them, the guards on the rocks would also call him
sir.
Roberta pours the white liquid from its crystalline pitcher into crystalline glasses that catch the light, refracting it and splintering it in random projections on the stonework of the balcony. He takes a bite of cookie, chocolate chip. Suddenly, the intensity of the flavor drags more memories out of hibernation. He thinks of his mother, then another mother, school lunch, burning his lip on a freshly baked toll house.
I like them best chewy and hot. I like them best hard and almost burnt. I'm allergic to chocolate. Chocolate is my favorite.
He knows all these things are true. How could they all be true? If he's allergic, how could he have so many wonderful chocolate memories?
The marathon riddle continuing,
he says. Roberta smiles.
That was almost a complete sentence. Here, have something to drink.
She holds the glass of cold white liquid to him, and he takes it.
Have you given any thought to your name?
Roberta asks, just as he takes a sip, and all at once, as the flavorful fluid dislodges a piece of soft cookie from the roof of his mouth, more thoughts fly in. The combination of tastes forces 100 thoughts through a sieve, leaving behind diamonds. The electric eye machine.
He knows what it's called. And the white stuff, it's from a cow, isn't it? Cow juice. Starts with an M. Electric eye. Cam! Cow juice. Moo!
Roberta looks at him strangely.
Cam! Moo!
He says again. Her eyes sparkle, and she says,
Camus.
Camus.
Camus! What a splendid name! You've outdone yourself.
Camera!
He finally says.
Milk!
But Roberta isn't listening anymore. He has sent her to a more exotic place.
Camus, the existential philosopher. Live to the point of tears. Kudos to you, my friend. Kudos!
He has no idea what she's talking about. But if it makes her happy, then it makes him happy. It feels good to know that he's impressed her.
Your name shall be Camus Composite Prime,
she says with a grin on her face as wide as the shimmering sea.
Won't the committee just die?
Advertisement.
Tired of all the fad diets? Painful hours at the gym with no results? We have the answer for you. Everyone knows a healthy heart is the key to feeling great. And with a new heart in peak condition, you'll actually want to exercise. Soon you'll see those pounds flying off and feel like a new you from the inside out. But don't take our word for it. Ask your doctor about nanosurgery.
Sponsored by the International Society of Nanosurgeons. Results not guaranteed.
From then on, each of his days begins and ends with therapy. Painful stretching followed by guided exercises and weightlifting that seem specifically designed to cause him the greatest amount of pain.
The healing agents can only do so much,
says his physical therapist, a deep-voiced bodybuilder with the unlikely name of Kenny.
The rest has to come from you.
He is convinced this therapist enjoys watching him suffer. Thanks to Roberta, those who don't just call him Sir now call him Camus. But when he thinks of the name, all that comes to mind is a big, black-and-white whale.
That's Shamu,
Roberta tells him over lunch.
You're Camus. It rhymes, but has a silent S.
Cam,
he tells her, not wanting to sound like a sea mammal.
Make it Cam.
Roberta raises an eyebrow, considering it.
We can do that. We can most certainly do that. I'll let everyone know. So, how are your thoughts today, Cam? Feeling a bit more cohesive?
Cam shrugs.
I have clouds in my head.
Roberta sighs.
Maybe so. But I can see your progress, even if you can't. Your thoughts are becoming a little clearer each day. You can string together longer strands of meaning, and you understand almost everything I say to you, don't you?
Cam nods.
Comprehension is the first step toward clear communication, Cam.
Roberta hesitates for a second, then says,
Comprends-tu maintenant?
Oui. Parfaitement,
says Cam, not knowing that something was different about it until the words came out of his mouth. He realizes that yet another door of mystery has opened inside his head.
Well,
says Roberta, a mischievous smirk on her face.
For the time being, let's go one language at a time, shall we?
New activities are added into his day. His afternoon naps are pushed back to make room for hour-long sessions sitting at a table-sized computer desktop filled with digital images, a red vehicle, a building, a black-and-white portrait, dozens of pictures.
Drag to you the images you recognize,
says Roberta on the first day of this ritual,
and say the first word that each image brings to mind.
Cam feels overwhelmed.
Scantron?
No, Roberta tells him.
It's not a test. It's just a mental exercise to find out what you remember and what you still need to learn.
Right,
says Cam.
Scantron.
Because her answer is the very definition of a test, isn't it? He looks at the images and does as he's told, pulling the objects he recognizes closer. The portrait.
Lincoln.
The building.
Eiffel.
The red vehicle.
Truck fire. No. Fire truck.
And on and on. As he pulls an image away, another sprouts to replace it. Some he has no problem identifying, others have no memories associated with them at all, and still others tug at the edge of his mind, but he can't find a word to attach to them. Finally, when he's done, he feels even more exhausted than he does after physical therapy.
"Basket,"
he says.
"Crumpled paper basket."
Roberta smiles.
"Wasted. You feel wasted."
"Wasted,"
Cam repeats, locking the word in his mind.
"I'm not surprised. None of this is easy, but you've done well, haven't you? And you are to be commended."
Cam nods, more than ready for a nap.
"Gold star for me."
Each day more and more is asked of him, both physically and mentally, but no explanation is given for any of it.
"Your success is its own reward,"
Roberta tells him, but how can he relish any success if he has no context with which to measure it?
"The kitchen sink,"
he tells Roberta at dinner one day. It's just the two of them. It's always just the two of them.
"The kitchen sink, now?"
She doesn't even have to probe to figure out what he means.
"In time, you'll know everything there is to know about yourself. Now is not that time."
"Yes, it is."
"Cam, this conversation is over."
Cam feels the anger well in him and doesn't know what to do with it, and he can't put enough words together to take it away. Instead, it goes to his hands, and before he knows what he's doing, he's hurling a plate across the room, then another, then another. Roberta has to duck, and now the whole world is flying dishes and silverware and glass. In an instant, the guards are on him, pulling him back to his room, strapping him to the bed, something they haven't done for over a week. He rages for what feels like forever, but then, exhausted, he calms down. Roberta comes in. She's bleeding. It's just a small cut above her left eye, but it doesn't matter how small it is. He did it. It was his fault. Suddenly, all his other emotions are overwhelmed by remorse, which he finds is even more powerful than anger.
"Broke my sister's piggy bank,"
he says in tears.
"Crashed my father's car. Badness. Badness."
"I know you're sorry,"
Roberta says, sounding as tired as him.
"I'm sorry, too."
She gently takes his hand.
"You'll be restrained until morning for your outburst,"
she tells him.
"Your actions have consequences."
He nods, understanding. He wants to wipe away his tears, but he can't, for his hands are secured to the bed. Roberta does it for him.
"Well, at least we know you're every bit as strong as we thought you'd be. They weren't kidding when they said you were a baseball pitcher."
Immediately, Cam's mind scans his memory for the sport. Had he played it? His mind might be disjointed and fragmented, so finding what it contains is always difficult, but it's easy to know what memories don't exist at all.
"Never a pitcher," he says. "Never."
"Of course not,"
she says calmly.
"I don't know what I was thinking."
Bit by bit, and day by day, as more things fall into place in Cam's mind, he begins to realize his terrifying uniqueness. It is night now. His physical therapy has left him, for once, feeling more exhilarated than exhausted. But there was something Kenny, the therapist, had said.
"You're strong, but your muscle groups don't work and play well with others."
Cam knew it was just an offhand joke, but there was a truth to it that stuck in Cam's craw, the way food often did, the way his throat didn't always agree to swallow what his tongue was pushing its way.
"Eventually your body will learn the alliances it has to make with itself,"
Kenny had said, as if Cam was a factory full of strike-prone workers, or worse, a clutch of slaves forced into unwanted labor. That night, Cam looks at the scars along his wrists, like hairline bracelets, visible now that the bandages have been removed. He looks down to the thick, ropey line stretching down the center of his chest, then forking left and right above his perfectly sculpted abs. Sculpted, like a piece of marble hewn into human form, an artist's vision of perfection. This cliffside mansion, Cam now realizes, is nothing more than a gallery, and he is the work on display. Perhaps he should feel special, but all he feels is alone. He reaches toward his face, which he has been told not to touch. That's when Roberta comes in. She knows he's been taking stock of his body, having spied on him through the camera lurking in the corner of the room. She is accompanied by two guards, for they can already tell Cam's emotions are starting to surge and threaten a tempest.
"What's wrong, Cam?" asks Roberta. "Tell me. Find the words."
His fingertips graze his face, which is filled with strange textures, but he's afraid to truly feel his face, for fear that in his anger he might tear it apart. "Find the words."
"Alice," he says. "Carol, Alice!"
The words are wrong. He knows they're wrong, but they are the closest he can get to what he wants to say. All he can do is circle, circle, circle the point, lost in orbit around his own mind.
"Alice!"
He points to the bathroom.
"Carol!"
A guard grins knowingly, but knowing nothing.
"Maybe he's remembering old girlfriends."
"Quiet,"
snaps Roberta.
"Go on, Cam."
He closes his eyes, forcing the thought to take shape, but the only form that comes is the ridiculous shape of
Walrus.
His thoughts are useless, pointless. He despises himself. But then Roberta says,
"And the carpenter?"
He snaps his eyes to her.
"Yes, yes."
Somehow, as random as those two things are, they make perfect sense.
"The Walrus and the Carpenter," says Roberta. "An absurd poem that makes even less sense than you."
He waits for her to connect at least some of the dots for him.
"It was written by Lewis Carroll, who also wrote
Alice."
"Yes, he wrote Alice in Wonderland, and through the
Looking Glass."
Cam points to the bathroom.
"Through the Looking Glass."
But he knows that's not the word people use for it anymore. The modern word is
mirror,
he shouts.
My face, in the mirror, my face.
There is not a single mirror anywhere in the mansion, or at least in the rooms he's allowed in. Not a single reflective surface anywhere. It could not be an accident.
Mirror,
he shouts triumphantly.
I want to look in a mirror. I want to look now. Show me.
It is the clearest statement and the highest level of communication he has yet to achieve. Surely Roberta will reward that.
Show me now! Ahora! Maintenant! Ima!
Enough,
says Roberta with calculated force in her voice.
Not today. You're not ready.
No!
He touches his face with his fingers, this time hard enough that it begins to hurt.
It's Doge in the Iron Mask, not Narcissus at the pool. Seeing will lighten the load, not break the camel's back.
The guards look to Roberta, ready to leap in, to restrain him, to tie him once more to his bed where he can't hurt himself. But Roberta does not give the order. She hesitates, considers. Then she finally says,
"Come with me."
She turns and strides out of the room, leaving Cam and his guards to follow. They leave the wing of the mansion that has been carefully designed for his protection, journeying to places that seem far less clinical. Rooms with warm wooden floors instead of cold linoleum. Framed artwork instead of bare white walls. Roberta tells the guards to wait at the door, and she leads Cam into a living room. There are people present, Kenny and some members of his therapy staff, as well as others whom Cam doesn't know, professionals of some sort who work behind the scenes of his life. When they see him, they rise from their leather chairs and sofas, alarmed by his presence.
"It's all right," Roberta tells them. "Give us a few minutes alone."
They drop whatever they're doing and scurry out. Cam would ask Roberta who they are, but he already knows. They're like the guards at his door, and the guards on the rocks, and the man who cleans his messes, and the woman who rubs lotion on his scars. All these people are there to serve him. Roberta leads him to a full-length mirror against a wall. He can see himself now, head to toe. He sheds the hospital gown and stands there in his shorts, looking at himself. The shape of his body is beautiful. He is perfectly proportioned, muscular and trim. For a moment he